It's just about time for us to begin our study for this morning. So if you would find your spots and open up your Bibles to the Gospel of Luke in chapters 9 and 10, we'll be picking up there for our study this morning. Before we get any more involved in that process, though, let's take a moment and begin our look into the message of God with prayer to our Creator and Mediator. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the blessing of your Son. We thank you for the blessing of forgiveness found through his role as mediator between God and man. Help us then to better understand our place on this earth. Help us to develop a character that is a reflection of Jesus. Help us to seek forgiveness and strength in him and in you. And this we ask in his name. Amen. So we are in the Gospel of Luke chapter 9, picking up around verse 37. We're going to move along as pace can go in class and kind of talk and study our way through the text. The primary chunk to begin with, though, is in chapter 9 and verse 37, looking through almost the end of the chapter, going all the way to verse 57. And to step us back into the setting and the circumstance here, it's important to recognize or remember that this goes on the heels of what we sometimes refer to as the transfiguration. That's the big technical term for it. But we also remember some of the details of the event. And before we kind of break into the text, here's a question for you. If someone came to you and asked you a series of questions about the transfiguration, how would you answer them? Not theological detail questions, but what was it? Who was there, and what did it look like? That's the foundation for all the rest of it. Like, what does it mean? How does it fit into the bigger story of the Bible? What's God trying to teach us with that event? What's going on? It starts with a conversation of, what is this? Who was there? What does it look like? Everything else flows out of that event. So how would you answer that question if someone said, hey, what's the transfiguration? Because the next question is, what's the transfiguration all about? That's the second half of it. Bobby?
Moses and Elijah met with Christ and talked with him about his suffering and death. Evidently, he was encouraging them that it wasn't really as bad as it sounded, because if we are living right with God, death is just a beginning of
right, so we've got some of the who and the what there, and then a little bit of the what's this all about on the other end of it. Roy, what about you? How would you answer that question?
I got out of emotion, but the emphasis was on Christ being the Son of God, and right, being the one that has been prophesied as coming.
Right, because there's another participant we haven't mentioned yet. We've got Jesus. Well, actually, there's a few participants we haven't mentioned yet. So we've got some Old Testament patriarch, prophet individuals coming in as a Old Testament side of things. Who else is present? There's at least two other groupings that are present here.
Peter, James, and John.
All right, so there's some close disciples. And who comes in at the end? God the Father, or Elohim, or Yahweh, or Adonai, or the Lord, comes in at the end and seals the conversation. Is that similar to anything else we've seen before, by the way?
Yes.
It is similar. What other similar events is that kind of like, if not very similar to? Yeah, the baptism of Jesus. And so if you find things that are similar, what do you tend to do? So there's a reason they're the same. Like, hey, these are here. I just found a nut and a bolt, and they're all the same dimensions. They've got the same diameter. They've got the same threading. They kind of go together. They're a pair. It's not always the case. Just because things are similar doesn't mean they're the same. That's a thing you got to keep in mind. But with the rarity of similar same events in the Bible, and God saying these things as God, that asks us a question. What's different about the audience in these two places?
Well,
Is the audience different significantly from the baptismal audience to the transfiguration audience? Big crowd, little crowd, right? A whole lot smaller. And what difference that's also standing out here is there is a transformation, right? Baptism is in part transformation on a theological level. You are transformed in that moment. You put on the new self and you put to death the old self. So baptism one for Jesus. What do they say the reason was? What did Jesus and John say that baptismal event took place for? Because it was
obedient
or necessary. Like, this is, we must do this. It wasn't necessarily because he had to or he needed to. He chose. He must. Let it be so. Is kind of the concept here. Now here, so there's a transformation moment that's like a transformation that's not, but it transformed the audience around it. Does Jesus transform at this moment? How does he change? What's the visualization there?
His appearance was very bright.
Right, dazzling, it says in one translation. His clothing became dazzling white.
Probably similar to Moses when he came off the mountain.
You could probably connect it to Moses coming down from the mountain, which kind of fits in the theme of what we've read recently in the Gospel of Luke as well. You have that law giving Moses to the mountain, Moses from the mountain context that's kind of echoing off of some of the earlier chapters. But now tie it back to baptism and kind of see all of this in picture. In our baptism, by biblical application, this is the what it's about side to kind of catch. We are transformed. We are made white. We are washed and made new, right? That takes place at the moment or the circumstances around our baptism. At the transfiguration, Jesus is going through his own demonstration of his nature. And so it's not so much that Jesus is made white or made new there. It's that the real nature of whom Jesus is revealed. Whomever Jesus actually is at that moment is now in essence shining through. That he is really God. And that's evidenced by the behavior of the Old Testament worthies, Moses and Elijah, who are present there. It's also evident by the behavior of the disciples, even though they don't really know what's going on. Like, oh, wait a minute, you're more than just a rabbi, you're more than just a prophet, you're even more than just the anointed one, because that's already in evidence. There's something else. And so they begin to realize, to whatever degree they accept, Jesus is more than they understood. And there's probably other things that we don't understand that are taking place in the text. Like, we get our surface level, we're human, God's teaching us level of understanding. There's other things happening all the time in biblical texts that we don't get. We're not mature enough, we haven't read it enough, we haven't learned enough of God's message, we haven't become enough like God in our ways of life and ways of thinking that we mature in that process too. There's more in the transfiguration too. Any last like introductory things before we move into the text? It's a great contrast in what happens next as well.
And the voice out of heaven claiming, "This is my beloved son."
Yeah, the relationship side. My beloved son. And we're going to hint on some of that this morning in our worship when we consider Colossians 1 as well. So think about this. It goes from this event here in close, tight-knit settings, people who are Jesus aware, like they know Jesus is more, they now know he's a whole lot more than they thought, to all the next events. And so some of the things that happen drive home some core principles in what's going on. Jesus is going to engage in healing again, demonstrate his power over the supernatural. He is going to hint, if not outright kind of acknowledge, that his next step isn't what they would think. You know, they're looking at it from the standpoint of, he's going to be here, he's going to keep leading us, he's the anointed. The cultural idea of the anointed of God in Israel was that the anointed would be an earthly king and rule. It doesn't matter that these disciples are much closer to the ideal. They all thought that. They all thought their king would set up a new Israel and renew Jerusalem. And so, reading in the text, verse 37, on the next day, they had come down from the mountain, kind of like a little hint to Moses. A great crowd met him, and behold, a man from the crowd cried out, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is my only child." And behold, a spirit seizes him, and he suddenly cries out. It convulses him so that he foams at the mouth and shatters him and will hardly leave him. "And I begged your disciples to cast it out, but they could not." Jesus answered, "O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you and bear with you? Bring your son here." While he was coming, the demon threw him to the ground and convulsed. But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the boy and gave him back to his father. And all were astonished at the majesty of God. So there's at least two things that are assumed in evidence before the story begins. What have the disciples been doing in absence of Jesus, or trying to do? To cleanse him, right? To cast out demons. Is that a little bit of a surprise reveal to a certain degree that the disciples had moved to that point of action? On one level, yes. But I'll point out a little bit of history. In the culture of Israel, and you can see this a lot in the Psalms, there is poetic and historical record that shows that in Israel, there was a large, not I say large, a significant vocal part of Israel that was in conflict with the spiritual realm in their writings and their behavior. And so it's not uncommon for them to try to cast out demons. Success rate is a different thing. When you read through some of the old writings from this era, they were zero success rate. Like, they just couldn't do it. They didn't stop for trying. They're asking God for help by prayer. They are petitioning to whatever historical precedents they could find. But in Jesus, they found solution to it. So it's not a surprise. But what's surprised here is the second thing. This father goes to these individuals with the idea that it can be successful, which suggests it had been successful in the past. That others, besides Jesus in his presence, had been successful in casting out, or at least he knew of them. That's part of the, like, he came to him and said, "I want your disciples." They tried and they failed. Why would he go to the disciples? All the possible reasons. They'd been successful in the past. He didn't know Jesus was the focal point and Jesus was the ones doing the miracles. Information we don't know. All that stuff. So all that's in the backdrop. All that said, what do you make of Jesus' comments about the generation that surrounds him? Is he condemning the father? He's saying, your faith is not strong enough, and so because of your weak faith, your son is suffering. Is that what he's saying?
No.
No. So if we intellectually and emotionally move that off the table, what else is left for us? What's he trying to tell us? Right, there's something. Yeah, there's something that's gone on that's diminished the zeal or the trust. And I'll kind of foreshadow a future lesson later in this year. We're going to be looking at a concept from the Old Testament and New Testament that helps us better understand the idea of fear. And I say that because fear is one of the many translations of a word that appears in the Old Testament and New Testament that ranges from truly afraid to trust. And I want you to start thinking about how fear and trust can be the same thing. Because here's a simple illustration. If you look at a machine that's running, let's say this machine is a wood chipper. Are you afraid of it? Absolutely. Those things terrify me in certain sections, especially the large versions that are wood chippers for cars. Like I am, and so I'm afraid of it. But I also trust its process enough that it's going to do its thing and it's going to function. And when I drop a car in there or a branch, it's not going to explode. And so that's a partial look at how that fear and trust can be related. Because you're fearing its power, but you also trust its power to do the thing it says it's going to do, whatever that is. So now you have the disciples who don't have enough faith, trust, in God to accomplish a task that Jesus is telling us they should be able to do. But he condemns them for it with some pretty harsh terms. Twisted. Faithless. Imagine receiving that. Rich?
When I look at the word disciples, I'm not so clear if it was just the 12 that were hanging out with me. Right? You probably have other folks who are claiming to be disciples.
We had one, for sure.
Right. So part of it is, he's asked the disciples, well, there are probably many of them beyond just the 12. And I guess that's kind of where my mind goes, is that there's always going to be folks out there that say, yeah, follow Jesus. And sure, I can cast out that demon, but not really. So, and I know that there's some of those as well, even in Acts, that shows some examples of that. So that's kind of where my mind goes in this particular instance.
Well, that's all of us, too. Like, you think about the newest Christian you know. The one that is newest in their faith. They've recently just really started seeking spiritual things. Now, think about the most considerate and mature Christian that you know. Is calling them disciples and Christians fair for each of them? Do you have different expectations for each of them? Well, absolutely. Like, I don't expect a new Christian to know in their behavior, in their actions, in their speech, what you would expect out of someone at a different point in their growth process. So the disciples are certainly going to be all over the place when we say the disciples. But in the New Testament, when the terminology disciples is used, it's very often used in a way that says this is a closer, smaller segment. It's divisive in the sense of not everyone who was following them, but the disciples. So there's a level of commitment that they've made in that. And in the different Gospels, it's used a little differently. It's not exclusively of the close disciples, because sometimes it's 70, sometimes it's more. So there is some space and range in that group size. But these are most definitely people that on the public level have said, Jesus is more, to whatever level you want to kind of extend that to. Also, I think it's important to kind of catch this, because you see this as the consequence of the next thing, because in verses that follow our story of the unclean spirit that appear kind of through verse 45 now, Jesus is going to talk about his future. And we all know pretty well, I think, that the disciples, the crowds, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, and basically everybody, and you might be able to exclude Mary, because that's a mystery to us, and you might be able to exclude the disciple whom Jesus loved, who took Mary into his household, as being maybe they got a little bit of it more, but their heart seems broken at the crucifixion. Nobody gets who Jesus is. They don't get it. They don't get not so much who he is, but how it's going to be necessary to go through the steps. That his death was going to be necessary to lead to his resurrection, and that we needed it. And you see it really highlighted in the way that the next passage brings up, things up. Just after explaining in the text, hey, this is concealed from them about his manner of death and resurrection, an argument arose among them as to which of them was the greatest. But Jesus, knowing the reasoning of their hearts, took a child and put him by his side and said to them, whoever receives this child in my name receives me, And whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For he who is least among you is the one who is great. You think about that for a second, and you think about how we still basically behave like squabbling kids wondering who's going to get the best place at the table. You ever go with a large group somewhere for a meal and watch how people seat themselves at the table? Like, where, if you've got grandkids, where do the grandkids want to sit? They jockey for position next to the grandmas. Like, for all the great reasons. Sometimes the grandpas get some leftover grandkids. But for the most part, they kind of congregate that way. And it's sensible. Because grandma's probably going to give them all the desserts off the side of the table. So it's like totally practical. But they also enjoy it. It's special. We do that. Sometimes lightheartedly. But also if you're at like a big corporate thing. Or a volunteer thing. Or a summit or an event. Or a wedding even. We still have who gets too close to the good table and who's in the outer banks. Like, okay, well, I'm glad I'm in the room, but I'm over here next to the speakers. Like, you know, and not the actual folks who are speaking, but the noisemakers are right behind my head. Like, that's like the low scrap table in a group, right? They're doing that same thing. Why are they trying to figure out who's going to be greatest in the kingdom? Besides the earthly thing. What's making this misunderstanding manifest this way? They were looking in their history books and recognized physical kingdoms. People in the court sometimes become king. Or at least they are treated like a king, right? Power, authority, opportunity. Oh, and just like it was in the Old Testament, so it is in the New, where you see a mom trying to make sure that her kids end up at the right spot at the right time. Full-on helicopter momming the environment. Hey, make sure my kid gets taken care of. I want them to be at the right table. The helicopter dads exist too. It's just a metaphor of helicopter moms. So you see all that taking place. The disciples are negotiating, and now they're bickering amongst each one or arguing who's going to be the greatest. And note, nobody gets excluded in that conversation. Because I think if you read through the apostles and you ask yourself, okay, who started that fight? Because I know someone else did that, had that same conversation of like, who started this fight? We all have our nominees, right? You don't have to give them up. You know, you don't have to rat out Peter that way. But in the end, they're all fighting. That's my guess, as Peter is involved somehow.
I'm kind of hung up a little bit back on who were the disciples and what is a disciple. Now, I think we all recognize that scripturally it is written that Jesus selected 12. But there was a time when he sent out as many as 70. Mm-hmm. These were people that were, in my mind, they were followers. And then when I fast forward to the day of Pentecost, there were 120 candidates there for the replacement of Judas. Now, all of these people had to meet a certain criteria to be in that selection. And I look at those two, they were all potential candidates for a position as an apostle. So there may have been those that were proclaiming to be followers of Jesus, but as the scripture is written, the true one, it was manifest in their behavior.
Right, here's a way to think about it. In the New Testament, particularly in the Gospels, the disciples is a class of people or a grouping of people. sometimes that grouping of people is very large. These are all disciples. They are all willing to be students of Jesus. By the way, the same word is used for the disciples of John, a very large group for themselves. And it's a classification. Jesus identifies from that subset of disciples at times closer individuals. Now, the point to recognize, though, is that in those gospel accounts, the normal or common use of disciples narrows itself down to what we consider the 12 plus one later down the road. One born out of due season, we kind of lump in that same category. But really, for this purposes, it really often is just the 12. The only way we can figure out if that's the case is by paying attention to context. Because it's just a word, context drives it. And so context in many cases makes it super obvious that it's just the 12 or one or two or three. And other times, like it is with the 70 or other larger events, it's all kinds of disciples. And we do this with it. We can and should self-identify as disciples of Jesus. And all those particulars that Joe was pointing out come into play. Like, am I living like one? Is it just a name-only experience? Am I a disciple in name only? Or am I actually trying to develop my faith and mature and act in a way that manifests the heart and behavior of God? So those are things that we always do with the text and with practical application of it. Like, who is this? Sometimes we simply do not know. And that's perfectly fair. To say, it says disciples, and we leave it at that. We might speculate or consider ourselves or debate, like, does context answer this question? And sometimes it simply doesn't. But the normative use almost exclusively, I would say exclusively, the normative or normal major use of it is these close disciples. Like, that's just the most common use of it. So it's easy to say most likely, but not always.
In this same account we're talking about, even where Jesus rebuked him for the little faith, that same account is in Matthew chapter 17.
Yep.
It's stated a little bit different, mainly because in this it says that they asked Jesus why. In verse 19 of chapter 17, it says, the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, why could we not cast it out? And he said, and then because of your little faith, for truly I say, if you had faith like a grain of a mustard seed, you would say to this mountain, move here and there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you.
Yeah.
That may bring a little more understanding to it by being said a little bit the way that they acted. Came and asked why. They didn't understand why.
Right, here's something to think about. Anybody have a mustard invasion in their gardens before? Like, do you realize how invasive mustard is? The mustard seed they're talking about here? It's like leaven. We tend to think about it in the sense of it has big outcomes, but it also is pervasive. It's an invasive seeding that takes over a space completely. And so when Jesus starts talking about mustard seed faith in contrast to everything else, it's allowing the time to take over and become the dominant thing that then produces so much. These apostles, as we will see them in the future, aren't there yet. And they also don't know everything. They could be there, they could be much farther along. Jesus rebukes them for the fact that they haven't grown right here. This is a growing point for them. So there's a lot going on there that we can kind of catch in some of this. The next part of the text that lays out here is interesting as well, because it's all in the same space of what happens after these big events. This starts in verse 51. When the days drew near for him to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem, and he sent messengers ahead of them who went and entered a village of the Samaritans to make preparations for him. But the people did not receive him, because his face was set towards Jerusalem. When his disciples, James and John, saw it, they said, Lord, do you want us to tell fire to come down from heaven and consume them? But he turned and rebuked them, and they went on to another village. So James and John seem to have growing faith, right? Let's tie it together with Les's kind of great comment from Matthew. Well, Jesus said that we could literally move mountains with our faith, so we can call down fire, right? And who have they just seen? In the earlier annals of the text, who have they just recognized? Moses and Elijah. And what have we been recently reading about in 1 Kings about Elijah? What's he do?
Call down fire.
Like, this is like top of the memory stuff. Like, I just saw this. I just remembered this. They don't want to hear you. Your face is set to Jerusalem. Let's call down some fire. That's their behavior. That's them being them and kind of interacting. And it shows us that human side of these disciples. And Jesus says, no, that's not what we're here to do. That's not our thing. Rich?
And I think it goes back to that maturity statement earlier on. Where are they in the maturity statement? I guess even if I look at my life, I was probably in that stage where it's like, oh, you don't want to listen to me? Then, you know, bring down fire, right? So yeah. That's what we do. We kind of go over the head of the Bible and say, you need to understand this. But I see Jesus going back to patience, love, understanding, interacting with these people. He doesn't want to destroy them because they won't let them pass through. But
yeah.
Part of that is backing off in the maturity level that says we need love and understanding here and not just destroy them. But I mean, but that's part of that maturity level, which is where some of his disciples are at. So.
And for all practical purposes, where we are at different times.
Yeah.
Do we have that same level of frustration when things spiritually are not moving in the way we want? Do we say some of the same kind of things? I hope that we're not calling fire down on our neighbors. But emotionally, the Bible says that some of the works of the flesh and the fruit of spirit are these progressive levels of despisal for one another. When it talks about murder on one end and anger on the other, the middle space includes a term that means I hate them enough to kill them. I won't kill them, but I hate them enough that it's equivalent to me having killed them, much like Jesus says in regards to adultery, that you committed adultery in your heart, even though you haven't actually committed the physical activity of adultery. So that, like, it's totally within the space of human behavior to feel that way. So now what about James and John, who are like figuring out what kind of ministry this is? They clearly think Jesus is going to be a king, physical, because that seems to be what their perspective is. The Bible shows some concealing aspects of it. They haven't seen it or understood it because it hasn't been fully revealed yet. There's that part of it. The history of Israel shows this is a thing. Does God destroy cities? Well, yeah. Yeah, he does. So this is like, it's not as far out as it might seem for some. Les?
It's kind of like when we teach our children, they learn boundaries. And Jesus is teaching them where their boundaries are, what they need to be focused on and doing, what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do.
Yeah. And again,
part of
that maturing, growing process, because we have a hint of their potential. God says through them, in a practical side, that he's going to listen to them and answer their prayers. Jesus says directly to them, your prayers will have the capacity to have the effective change on the physical environment. You can move a mountain. They logically connect it and said, well, Elijah didn't make it rain. Like he stopped raining by his prayer. God held back the rains. Elijah called down fire. I can call down fire. Like that's the steps that they go through. Very rational. Like Les is pointing out, they have to learn, I got to put some boundaries on my behavior. And Jesus, at this point, says, we're not doing that. And he gives a little qualification. As they mature in the New Testament, when they're working as apostles, do we see them behave like they do here? Do the apostles start calling down fire broadly? What about that Acts event where Ananias and Sapphira are involved? And some of that. And that's not the only instance where God's power is manifest in a physical way that is a little bit different. So one of the things that happens that makes it different, they're identified as disciples and God's hand is directly involved. You know, God's a participant. But they don't act surprised. And that's the thing is, like the apostles, like we knew this was a possibility. And it was a possibility under the old law too. Like dishonesty in the spiritual space or temple space of God's people, and there are deathly consequences to that. Les?
Yeah. Just men.
Yeah.
So you know, that makes some kind of a difference in there.
There's some things going on. Like, bottom line, just as a side note, and the things never to do, don't lie to the Spirit, don't grieve the Spirit. Like, that's like, if you want a boundary that's equivalent to the Old Testament, that's the line you don't cross. If that was necessary for you to know, then you should know that now and like kind of see that. But on a practical level, you see again these disciples developing faith, and then later they practiced that developed faith, where they shifted their focus to the things that actually matched the mission very much into what Jesus was doing. Like all the same kind of things. Helping poor, helping the sick, preaching the message, emphasizing the message over the mission. You know, like, oh, I'll be okay. They are the mission in that sense. I'll be all right. If I'm hurt, it's okay. If I'm in prison, it's going to be okay. You see them behaving in the way that Jesus was teaching them. It's a great aspect of the book of Acts in comparison to Luke.
And they go so far with this in their learning of doing what Jesus wants them to, that then they start taking this physical abuse without trying to have any retribution against the people that are doing that, which is just totally opposite of what they were in the beginning.
Now, they were all about personal issues. I want to be empowered. I want to get vengeance. I want to be on top again. All those kind of things. And that shifted as they matured. Rich?
I think it goes into that the gospel is for all as well. Because we're talking about a group of Samaritans. And the relationship between them and the Samaritans wasn't that great, right? So I think they were in that mindset. It's like, well, but again, part of that maturity process is that Jesus is trying to help them to understand it's more than just that.
Yeah, and the next thing that comes in is a challenging thing. How many decisions in your life that are super significant also included a long period of cost calculation? Where you figured out, hey, this is what this is actually going to be like, and this is what it's going to look like. Do you have a few things like that in your experiences? Going to buy a house, going to move to an area, going to start a program to learn something. Even as simple, I think I'll learn how to play guitar. The first thing you learn is that your fingers hurt, right? And the finger pads, your tips of your fingers get destroyed when you learn how to play guitar. It doesn't matter if it's a classical guitar, an acoustic guitar, an electric guitar. You start building calluses, right? But day one, you did not know that. And at the end of day one, you're like, my fingers hurt. So you didn't count the cost. Or maybe you did, and you didn't understand it. Now, Jesus talks about that a couple of times in the teaching of his word. How many times later, though, on big decisions, did you realize I didn't have the appropriate calculations in play? Like, you could talk about your fingers hurting after learning a guitar. That's a pretty easy one. But all the facets of life, we don't always have enough calculation space or the right equations to count these costs. But Jesus tells us to do that in view of the kingdom, and he always posits one thing as what you're actually calculating against. What's the one thing that these calculations in Jesus' context always balance on? Your soul. Your you. The individual unique entity outside the flesh that identifies you as being you and whatever that looks like in the spiritual realm. Something that is incalculable in value. And yet he still says, count the cost, and says it's difficult. Out of the same mouth, he says, bring your burdens to me, lay them on me, particularly if you are weak and weary. What I want to suggest to you is the idea of counting the cost is more than just, is it worth it? But also considering, what does that worth and process look like? Is the process something that I'm appreciating and understanding? Is the concept underneath the process something I'm recognizing? Because it's pretty easy to do the calculus. My soul's in jeopardy, I better do this. That's like a simple thing. That's not even calculus anymore, right? That's basic mathematics. But to count this cost includes all of that. And it comes on the heels of a conversation about his death that's best understood, followed by a maturing faith educational experience. Their faith grows. To this part of the text, which is, as they were going along the road, someone said to him, I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said to him, foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. To another he said, follow me. But he said, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. And Jesus said to him, leave the dead to bury their own dead. But as for you, go and proclaim the kingdom of God. Then another said, I will follow you, Lord, but let me first say farewell to those who are at my home. Jesus said to him, no one who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God. These are process considerations, not soul valuation considerations. And consider the process of what it means to be a disciple. And by the way, in the first century, in Israel, people going forth to preach is not a new thing. What we would call itinerant or traveling preachers, pretty normal thing. You actually meet conceptually a lot of them in the text. Anytime you find a zealot, they are equivalent to an itinerant preacher because they were proclaiming that Israel needed to rise again and throw off the shackles of its oppressors on both a physical and a spiritual rationale as being the chosen of God. When you meet in the text the Sadducees and the Pharisees who argued for their level of spiritual participation, they are in effect proclaiming and preaching in their communities as well. And there are some we don't directly interact with in the New Testament that existed as well in the first century that would travel around and preach and tell people we got to go back to God, which is often what you see the prophets in the Old Testament doing as well. And so you see this. It's not a surprise. Got 2 minutes before the clock goes out, and so we'll pause right here at the end of chapter 9. Any last comments or questions for this part of our study? A reminder. Oh, go ahead, Gary.
Is this where the demon possession ends when Christ is raised and we have the end of putting the gospel together?
You see a little hints of it in the book of Acts. Behaviorally, there's some follow-on to that. Historically, it goes away too. In the history of Israel, first to third century, it never really reappears. It doesn't appear in the behavior and writing of early church participants until the 10th century. And in those cases, it's very speculative when they start writing about it. And so among believers who professed a discipling idea of Jesus, it vanishes in their writings and remembrances at some point around the destruction of Jerusalem is kind of where the ending point of that is. I'm being vague about that date because they really don't know for sure when they stop writing about it and experiencing it culturally.
Yes. A quick little thing on it. Luke 10 and 17, we're talking about the 70 or the 72. Some versions have 70, some have 72. They came back, after they had come back from that, they said, Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name. So they had learned something through this.
Yeah, they learned, we can actually speak in a way that they respond to and are subject to, as a way to think about it. That's it for today, time-wise. Next Sunday, we'll be back in the Gospel of Luke, and Rich will be teaching class next Sunday. I think Rich remembers that, so but he's going to be teaching for us next Sunday, and so I'm sure he'll do a great job, and you'll have a great study. Thanks, everybody.